Now's your time to go ahead and throw some questions out there, and I'll intercept them and try to orient them towards some folks so everybody gets a chance. So here we can have some more, I was going to say meaty, but I'll say more substantial questions. So who's the first to have some? Yeah.
This might really be a clarifying question for Eric. I know the diet versus dominion.
Okay,
can
so
you
the question. And I'll repeat for the purposes of the podcast. So the question that was asked is, what do you mean by diet versus dominion? And this is specifically for Eric.
Okay, I'm going to go straight to the vegan source book by Joanne Stefaniak. And diet versus dominion. The first thing is, it focuses on degrees of compassion. And she has this quote in here by Ren Berry: becoming vegan has sensitized me to the feelings of all my fellow beings. I can truthfully say that being a vegan has made me a more compassionate person. If, as Buddha said, eating meat extinguishes the seed of compassion, then the converse is true. Being a vegan fosters the growth of the seed of compassion that is within all of us. So when someone eats a certain way, and they all of a sudden think they're better than someone, they're not a vegan. They're definitely not a vegetarian, and they're definitely not a compassionate human being. That's what I mean.
Okay, another question. Hugh.
Yeah, it's from Lauren. I'm a vegan, but I don't, and I understand your point about nonviolence towards animals. I certainly agree with it. But I don't believe, really, that being a vegan ensures that you're a peaceful person by any means.
Let me repeat.
A lot of conflicts in life that we produce.
Okay, if I could summarize Hugh's question. Hugh is questioning specifically for Lauren. He's saying, I question your point that being vegan is good enough, and that being vegan means that, end of story, you're ethical. But really, you're saying there's more to the story than just veganism, and you want Lauren to comment on that? Is that?
I'm saying that being vegan doesn't ensure peace.
So being vegan doesn't ensure peace. So what is your, how do you respond to that?
I certainly didn't mean to get that impression that that's what I thought. Was there something that I said specifically that gave you that impression?
Yeah, I think you just about said that.
What did I, can you remind me? I mean, I can look at it, but.
You can go back and take a look at it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't, I think it's an important part of being a peaceful person, and it seems to me that if you're not vegan, that
well, you're definitely overlooking the violence towards animals.
Right, vegan. And I would say that I would agree with you there, but it does seem like someone who is sensitive to the interests of animals is likely, as I have found personally, most vegans are, to be exceptionally compassionate people, that compassion becomes one of the central ideals in their life.
Anybody else? What's another burning question you have? Yeah, please.
Kind of working off that, maybe to whatever members of the panel want to address it. A lot of the suggestions, which I think were very good, focused on individual action, whether it is being vegan or being ways of being peaceful, or not taking more than your share of resources. And what I'd like to get a response to is that while that can have, certainly this individual action can have some impact, are we neglecting the kind of overriding importance of systemic change? The fact that we have, regardless of how many of us live more compassionate lives, with the current government we have in this country, I'm not sure that's going to help the Iraqis much.
Okay, let me summarize the question. The question is that actions start with the individual. Margaret Mead had that famous quote that, forgot the quote, but you all know it, that change begins with the individual, something of that nature. So the question is, I acknowledge that change can begin with the individual, but is that sufficient? And don't we need to have some rather large changes? I'd like to invite, Stevie had talked about the importance of individual action. I'd like her to address this, as well as Brandon. Brandon talked kind of about the institutional changes and how we need to look at it from a larger perspective. So perhaps the two of you would like to handle this question, that'd be good. Starting with Stevie.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And, you know, I don't know how else to get to societal change and governmental change without a whole lot of individuals speaking out and doing things. I don't know any other way of getting to it. Certainly a violent revolution is out of the question. So, you know, I definitely agree. I think, yeah, the structures of society definitely have to change, but they take a long time, and they take a lot of efforts, and sometimes these generations, you know. That's all I have to say.
Okay, well, social movements always precede political change. You can't have political change almost ever without having a organized social movement behind it. So I believe if enough individuals make changes, it'll coalesce into a viable social movement that will bring the necessary political changes that will bring positive action for the Earth and for everyone living on it.
Okay, next question. Yeah, Ed.
Another question for Lauren. You mentioned very briefly making veganism compulsory through legislation. Can you expand on justification for that and why we should make it codified in a law, for example, versus making it purely a moral persuasion?
Let me summarize the question and broaden it, if I may, Ed. The question is, in particular, veganism was one issue raised by Lauren, and can you ever find something which is universal that really should be dictated by law to help everybody? So I'd like to target this question to Lauren to specifically answer that. I'd also like to ask Mary Ann, who talked about the criminal justice system and how our actions result in penalties, whether you might add some comments in terms of if we do know something out there that, you know, is there anything out there, maybe veganism, maybe compassion, something that should be legislated? And maybe we can talk about that from the health, from the penalty point of view. So
I would just say that it seems to me that the animal rights, the movement for animal rights, is following past social movements like the abolition of slavery or for women's rights, and that, for those of us working in the movement, the belief for many of us is that animals are individuals whose interests should be respected just as anyone else's, and that to make sure that their interests are not violated, the status of animals currently is as a property. They're property. Dogs and cats and cows, these are all commodities, things that can be bought and sold and owned. And the idea is that we have to have a legal protection of animals' interests, and that is through rights. So I see that coming.
Mary Ann, can you address it not from a vegan point of view, but from a point of view of, are there any things that we should legislate from a criminal justice perspective that we ought to do proactively?
I personally, no, I don't like the idea of legislating things like what people should eat, any more than I think we should legislate how they have sex or with whom they have it. I think that we have enough laws. I think they are just not administered fairly and justly. And I don't think that's going to change until we change criminal justice system, which depends on the people in power, and particularly the whole society is dependent upon the messages that we receive from the very top of our society. As long as we are saying we have to do something violent, like go to another country and fight a war instead of straightening out our infrastructure and giving education to those that need it, providing health for those, care for those who need it. I don't think we're going to change until we change some of the administration that's in power at the present time.
Okay. So let me add that.
Sure.
Okay. I like what Lauren said when he talked about the property status of animals. It is impossible to legislate animal rights right now because of the property status of animals. So until we have a viable social movement that can force that change, it's not going to work. But I think being an animal rights activist, animals deserve the right not to be property and not to be used for any purpose. And if it was a human, we would definitely be supporting legislation outlawing eating humans, wearing human skin,
that's right,
and testing on humans. So it's nothing other than speciesism that keeps animals in the position that they are. So I think legislation will come if enough people demand it, but it's going to take a long social movement before that happens.
Do you have a comment?
I just have a comment that I thought of about testing on humans. We live in a community where there's testing on humans every day, many times a day, and I don't agree with it for the most part.
Linda, you have a question.
Well, I'm not arguing one direction or another. I was just throwing in a comment that came up as you said, you know, that how complex it does get when you say, I don't believe there should be legislation on who you have sex with or how, but I would imagine that you would think that, you know, sex with a three-year-old child was that somehow that should be legislated. That three-year-old child cannot protect themselves. And so I just throw that in as, like, it can get complex because, you know, because of that. And then I guess, again, I would argue in a sense, and I'm not arguing for legislation of what we eat, I would hope we would all move closer that way. But to me, animals, for the most part, are unable to speak for themselves or to protect themselves, and so therefore they do deserve somebody, something to stand up for their rights.
And before we move on to the next question, let me just summarize the point that you're making. If you're interested in following this track, Tom Regan has this notion called moral agenthood. And actually, when I've spoken for Society for Ethical Culture, I've talked about moral agenthood, and that's exactly what that's about. Chris, you had a question.
Yeah. Since the topic has come up, I can see there's a divergence on the panel as to what constitutes violence. I would be tempted to define violence as forcing someone to do something against their will. And legislation is what we eat. Would fall after that, although it would be, I understand the moral purpose behind that, but there you get into a conflict between a higher moral purpose, but then equally conflicting aim, which is, do you have a right to force someone to do something they don't want to do?
Okay, so let me summarize. So Chris's comment is that maybe legislating something that minor to people, whatever, think is a more compassionate thing. Once you start creating laws, maybe you're creating violence on others and imposing on other people's free will. I'd like to ask both Randy and Eric to address this. I'd like to ask Randy to address it from the point of view of sustainability. And Randy, you had talked about violence. So if we identify something that's violence, is it ever incorrect to try to legislate that and impose that on other people? And Eric, after Randy, I'd like you to address it from a love point of view. Is there something, can we legislate love, compassion, or is this something that we have to rely on individual people's natures? So if I could invite the two of you to take that, please.
Okay. We do have legislation that protects the rights of people. And the critique that I would bring to your comment, Chris, is that it is... seeing the rights of people as trumping the rights of animals. That if you buy that, then your statement that you can't impose on people's choices that way is correct. But looking at that premise, which different people in this room would say no, that you have to have more of an equality between the rights of people and the rights of animals, then that premise then becomes faulty. So it's something that I'm struggling with. But from a sustainability perspective that you mentioned, I think one thing that I'm finding out is I'm enjoying, we have a family connection, but with the Durham Farmers Market, the ability to eat local. And then that is a very nice move in the sustainable direction. And there are local animal products that are offered there as well. If you just look at it from an ecological perspective rather than an animal rights perspective, the protein that you can get from some of those local sources has a smaller carbon footprint than the some of the vegetable protein that you get from that nice brick of tofu or something that's made in California and shipped here. But, you know, so all these things are quite complicated. But, you know, I'm still like struggling with the ethical issues, and I try to have a very, very low meat diet myself. But I'm processing some things that I've heard tonight, too.
So. Hopefully we're all learning. Eric, can you address this from a love point of view?
All right. Now, what I'm going to say is not going to sound very lovely, but we're ignorant. Me too. Ignorant from the perspective of where there's a lack of education. And I'm reading from Fit for Life. Harvey and Marilyn Diamond, before they separated, they wrote this book called Fit for Life. And when it was introduced to me, I said, yeah, that's a load of crock, you know. And then when they got divorced, I said, see, it didn't work for them. They weren't fit for life. But it still had very good information. And I learned, like my wife always tells me, don't look at someone else, first look at you. Compare yourself to a room full of yous. Are you the best you that you can be? And I liked how Dilip said, when you point at someone else, you got four fingers pointing right back at you. That's kind of cool. All right, here it is. How much protein do we need? Let's face it. And this is going to go right along the lines with meat, fish, and it's going to go right along the lines of what you said of humans get tested on all the time. I'm reminded of taking our daughter to get an immunization shot. And my wife loves studying. And she found out that there was no need for this particular type of immunization. In fact, it was done away with in 72. So she asked the pediatrician, why are you administering this shot to my child and they don't need it? Well, if you don't sign it, and instantly it's the fear. And if you don't sign it, you're going to fill this paper out and you're going to say you refused it and we're going to call somebody about you. And it's like, oh my goodness. So do we go with groupthink or do we go with education? And too often times we go with education. No, we just go with groupthink. It's a lot easier. We don't create any waves. So the people who sell meat, fish, cheese, eggs, chicken, and all the other high prestige and expensive sources of protein, raising the amount of protein you eat raises their income actually by about 30%. So these are billion-dollar industries. We could talk about propaganda and media, you know, the incredible edible egg. Okay. It also increases the amount of protein in the sewers, septic tanks of your neighborhoods by 30% as you merrily urinate away everything that you can't use that very day. You know, if you urinate and it's yellow, something's wrong. If it's yellow and stinky, it should be as clear as this water. It's your body saying, hey, something's wrong. It's not just for colorful writing and snow. It also, somebody see.
There's a song by Frank Zappa.
It also deprives the starving children of the world of the protein that would save their lives. Incidentally, it makes you pay 30% of your already bloated food bill for protein that you will never use. If you are an average American family, it will cost you about $40 a month to unnecessarily pump up your protein intake. That puts another $36 billion a year into the pockets of protein producers, and it will bring you 30% closer to osteosclerosis. So where do we get our protein? It's called a knee-jerk protein reflex. People just ask, where do you get your protein from? Oh yeah, you're vegan, where do you get your protein from? You know, I get my wife went out for an evening and a woman was at this restaurant, I'm not gonna say the name because you may go there, but they have a lot of different kinds of meats. And this one particular woman was just tearing food up. And my wife was just eating, you know, her meal. We already said we're not gonna make others uncomfortable with the way we eat. And one woman said, they know already about my wife's diet, she said, well, I'm going to keep eating meat because meat's a complete protein. It's a complete protein. And it's like, wait a minute. Study for 10 seconds. My wife's first name is Valene. If you pronounce it incorrectly, it's valine, which is one of the 8 amino acids. The 8 essential amino acids, that's why she's essential to my life. She's one of the 8 essential. All right. The 8 essential amino acids basically are consumed in your body so that your body can produce protein. So it's a mute point. As long as these billion-dollar industries have you running around saying, count your carbs. Hey, where are you going to get protein from? B12 controversy. Wait a minute. Does anybody disagree that spinach has over 49% protein? Or does anybody disagree that these billion-dollar industries want to keep us confused?
Let me, thanks for the detailed answers. Let's move on to one or two final questions. And let's, for fairness, we've been focusing on veganism. Let's talk about some of the other wonderful issues that were also brought up.